I expect there to be a fair amount of continuity with the Biden administration and the Trump administration.
Asia priorities for President Biden. It's Tuesday, January 26th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Find us online at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, Australia shuts borders, a student tuition strike, mandating masks, a unified government, and a hybrid classroom robot. It's all on today's VOA Asia. As President Joe Biden gets to work and sort through urgent needs, longer-term priorities, and legacy projects, VOA Asia is delving into how the new president may deal with Asia. Today, Ira Melman speaks with Michael Kugelman, Deputy Director of the Asia Program and Senior Associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center Think Tank in Washington.
Keeping in mind that Biden's initial focus will be domestically in the U.S., I do think that his main priority in South Asia will be the situation in Afghanistan. The Taliban insurgency has never been stronger. Violence is intensifying to levels not seen in years. And a very nascent peace process between the Afghan government and the Taliban is really struggling. So I think that for the Biden administration, its plan in Afghanistan will be and should be its main priority in South Asia. It's going to need to make a lot of decisions very quickly related to its future troop posture in the country and also involving its role in the fragile peace process.
What happens as far as the talks between the Taliban and the United States and Afghanistan?
Well, what's interesting is that the talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban have really slowed down in recent weeks. And I think one reason for that is that each side wants to wait and see what the U.S., what the Biden administration does. And the Biden administration has not really said all that much, at least not publicly, about its intended policy in Afghanistan. But there is indeed an agreement concluded by the Trump administration and the Taliban back in February of last year, which calls for all U.S. troops to be out of Afghanistan by the end of April or early May, so long as the Taliban has upheld its commitment to sever ties with al-Qaeda. So that's going to be a big question for this new administration. What does it do if it concludes by the end of April or early May that the Taliban has not severed its ties with al-Qaeda? Will the Biden administration try to get tough on the Taliban and hold its feet to the fire and say, well, we're not leaving, we're not pulling out the rest of our troops until you make it quite clear that you are severing your ties with al-Qaeda? And given that Biden has long looked at Afghanistan through the lens of counterterrorism, I would think that for him it would be important to ensure that he's doing everything possible to get the Taliban to stop cooperating with al-Qaeda. Now, will the Taliban actually be willing to play ball in that regard? That remains to be seen. And at the end of the day, I think the Biden administration will have limited patience. It's not going to want to have Afghanistan on its policy radar all that much. It will want to eventually wash its hands of the situation by effecting a responsible withdrawal of the remaining U.S. forces. But the timing, the sequencing at this point, that's all up in the air.
What about Pakistan, India, other South Asian countries?
I expect there to be a fair amount of continuity with the Biden administration and the Trump administration when it comes to policy toward Pakistan and India. The Biden administration will look at its relationship, will look at the U.S. relationship with India as a priority. There has long been strong bipartisan consensus in Washington for a deep security partnership with India. That won't change. The Biden administration will view China, like the Trump administration, as a strategic threat and will look to India as a key country to work with the U.S. to push back against China. With Pakistan, very different. Again, like with Trump, I think that Biden will want the relationship with Pakistan to be a workable one, but a relatively limited one, one that for Biden will revolve around trying to get Pakistan to help pressure the Taliban to reduce its violence and to sever ties with al-Qaeda. And I think there also could be some grounds for cooperation on counterterrorism issues, particularly efforts to combat Daesh, or the ISIS, the Islamic State terror group, which has a presence mainly in Afghanistan, but also in Pakistan. But beyond that, I really don't see much scope for Biden wanting to expand the U.S. relationship with Pakistan. And that's just because the relationship with India will be a priority. And I think that Pakistan's close alliance with China will make it difficult for the Biden administration to justify expanding its relationship with the Pakistanis.
If China continues to make inroads in Pakistan, which it's trying to do, obviously, doesn't that become more important?
Well, absolutely. And we've seen a trend over the last few years that China has been intensifying its investments and its broader footprint in Pakistan, mainly through the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which is the Pakistan component of China's Belt and Road Initiative. There has, however, been some loss in momentum of the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. Pakistan has become more cautious given its own economic struggles, and it has not wanted to take on new loans and has not wanted to commit to many new projects with China. But indeed, that Chinese investment in Pakistan will continue. And this is something that the Trump administration during its last 2 years in power had been openly critical of. And I imagine that we'll see the same from the Biden administration. Now, it's interesting. There's a trend here that even though Biden's going to come to power with an incredibly different worldview from Trump, very different policies, in many South Asian countries, Pakistan, India, Afghanistan, you actually are going to see a lot of convergence, a lot of similarities between Biden and Trump.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking with South Asia expert Michael Kugelman. We'll continue tomorrow with China and how the new Biden administration might deal with many issues there. These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. Thailand says COVID-19 vaccinations to begin next month. Why China plans to place its super offshore oil rig in a disputed sea. Indian Army says Indian and Chinese troops face off along border. Cave dwellers in Afghanistan struggle to survive winter. Is Jack Ma helping China reinforce communist regime's digital authoritarianism? You'll find expanded coverage of all these stories and much more when you visit Facebook at VOA Asia and our website at voanews.com. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Australia has said it could keep its external borders closed for the rest of 2021 because of the coronavirus. 28,721 coronavirus cases have been reported in Australia since the beginning of the pandemic. Over 900 people have died, as we hear more from Phil Mercer in Sydney.
Australia closed its international borders to foreign travellers in March. It's been a key part of the nation's COVID-19 strategy, along with mass testing, sophisticated contact tracing, and strict lockdowns. The cautious response to the pandemic has been mostly successful. There are estimated to be 203 active coronavirus cases in Australia, and airlines had hoped overseas travel would resume as early as July. But that's unlikely, according to the head of the health department, Professor Brendan Murphy. He was asked by the Australian Broadcasting Corporation if the nation's international border controls would be relaxed this year.
The answer is probably no. I think we'll go most of this year with still substantial border restrictions. Even, you know, if we have a lot of the population vaccinated, we don't know whether that will prevent transmission of the virus, and it's likely that quarantine will continue for some time. So I think at the moment we've got this light at the end of the tunnel, the vaccine, so we're going to go as safely and as fast as we can to get our population vaccinated, and then we'll look at what happens.
An inoculation campaign is set to begin in Australia next month. Citizens, permanent residents and some foreign nationals with exemptions are allowed to enter Australia if they complete a 14-day hotel quarantine at their own expense. However, there are strict quotas on the number of travellers allowed to return home because of capacity constraints within the hotel system and concerns about the spread of the highly contagious British strain of coronavirus. This month, authorities have granted entry to about 1,200 tennis players, staff and officials for the Australian Open. Under biosecurity guidelines, players are allowed to train at dedicated venues for a few hours each day. But several recent arrivals have tested positive to the virus, forcing dozens of players to be confined to their hotel rooms for 2 weeks. Australia created a so-called travel bubble with neighbouring New Zealand late last year, but it only operates one way, with inbound flights to Australia. The border closures have hit the tourism industry hard. In 2019, more than 9 million overseas tourists visited Australia. The education sector, once popular with Chinese and Indian students, has also been badly damaged by Australia's travel ban on most foreign nationals. Australians wanting to travel overseas must have government permission. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, rescuers in China found 9 bodies Monday after Sunday's dramatic extraction of 11 survivors, raising the death toll from the mine collapse to 10, with one still missing. You'll find more online with VOA 60 as you stay up to date with VOA. This is VOA Asia. It's nice to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Student loan debt in the United States accounts for over $1.7 trillion. That's a figure higher than the GDP of countries like Canada, Russia, and South Korea. Now, students at one of the most prestigious universities in the United States say they will withhold their tuition payments. VOA's Keith Kosinski in New York has more.
When I say tuition, you say strike. Tuition!
Strike! This group outside Columbia University's library is demanding tuition relief during the coronavirus pandemic. The private Ivy League university in New York City boasts over 31,000 students with tuition around $60,000 a year. Student organizers gathered over 4,000 signatures with a list of demands for the university, including a 10% reduction in the attendance cost during the spring semester.
Even though we are getting a much different product that we agreed to at the beginning of attending Columbia, we're still being asked to pay the same price.
Show me what solidarity looks like!
Thousands of students have pledged to withhold their tuition payments beginning Friday, January 22nd. But the high cost of college education is nothing new.
This problem of affordable education has existed long before the pandemic. This issue of affordable education is much larger than Columbia. And there are students everywhere struggling with these same questions about how to afford college when the cost keeps rising every single year.
Student debt is the second highest form of financial obligation in the U.S. It's estimated 70% of American students take out school loans to pay for higher education, with an average debtor owing over $36,000 for their federal loans. However, students aren't the only ones facing financial challenges. Higher education institutions are now investing more in areas like online learning during the pandemic. And while private schools like Columbia are funded by private donors and tuition fees, public institutions rely on state subsidies.
Pre-pandemic, the financial situation was not that great. States have pulled back on funding. There's less public support for higher education. And because of that, the cost has gone to the students. Student tuition dollars go up, fees go up. That's a fundamental challenge and fundamental issue. And that's the long-term question. Who's going to pay for all of this?
Last month, Columbia University officials announced they will increase financial aid for the spring semester and cease to charge late fees for tuition payments in January. In a statement from Columbia, they say, "This is a moment when an active appraisal of the status quo is understandable, and we expect nothing less from our students. Their voices are heard by Columbia leadership, and their views on strengthening the university are welcomed." Some other universities and colleges have already eased the burden by reducing tuition costs and fees because of the pandemic.
What we're seeing here, you know, we've accomplished so much, but this is just the first step. So continuing this movement, reaching out to as many people, we're going to build something stronger, and they will listen to us eventually. But it takes people power.
Tuition strike organizers claim to have met with students from over 70 different schools throughout the U.S. and the U.K., discussing ways to organize a tuition strike. Experts say some higher education institutions may not withstand the financial burden of the pandemic, and consolidation may be the best way to survive. Keith Kosinski for VOA News, New York.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see, with links to easily find them. VOA Asia Twitter, we're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia. Indonesian authorities say they seized Iranian and Panamanian tankers suspected of carrying out an illegal transfer of oil in their country's waters off the West Kalimantan province Sunday. You'll find all the big stories throughout the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. You're listening to VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, the mayor of Los Angeles, California, Eric Garcetti, recently announced police will begin arresting anti-mask protesters who harass others for wearing face masks. Angelina Bagsarian has the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
Since August, people who refuse to wear face masks in Los Angeles have to pay a fine of up to $2,000. Despite that, there are people who still refuse to wear masks, despite scientific evidence the coverings help prevent the spread of the coronavirus.
No more masks! No more masks!
Roman Drake is one of them. He doesn't wear a mask and believes the strict regulations are a way to control people, not keep them safe.
I feel like some of the reactions I've seen from these people, that it's some kind of submission or something to get along with our current society. You have to do what they want you to do, and I don't want to do it, you know, and that's not American. It's not the way I grew up.
Los Angeles police have been criticized in the past for being too lenient towards anti-maskers, but officers say they try not to escalate the situation unnecessarily. Most people who do wear masks say they do it not only to protect themselves, but also to protect the community.
I feel like it's safe for me and for other people too. We never know, because I know friends and relatives who got tested positive without even having symptoms. So I want to still be alive.
If you care about other people, you should definitely wear a mask. These things work, so wear it, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, open up the businesses, but at least do this for other people.
Los Angeles County recently became the nation's first to surpass 1 million coronavirus infections, with COVID-19-related deaths coming every 7 minutes. So masks are more important than ever, say authorities.
Now is the time to avoid, as much as possible, contact with others that aren't in your household. When you must go out to work or for essential services, always wear a mask, keep your distance from others.
Statistics suggest almost 75% of Americans support mask wearing. While some ignore those who don't, others don't hesitate to call the police.
We've been going to that Beverly Hills rally. We go to the Beverly Hills rally every Saturday. We don't wear masks. Just this last Saturday, we did have a woman go up to the police and try to get them to give us a ticket, and they wouldn't do it.
Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti is trying to deal with that problem. He addressed the anti-maskers through the LA Times newspaper, saying, "Don't test us on this because you will find yourself in jail, cited, or dealing with prosecution." Garcetti also gave orders to the city police to arrest those who participate in large parties, which are officially banned in L.A. For Angelina Bagdasarian in Los Angeles, Anna Rice, VOA News.
Making headlines in Asia, Hong Kong-based Hanson Robotics has plans to mass-produce thousands of robots by the end of 2021, after a robot named Sophia they released in 2016 became a viral sensation. They created her to promote human-to-machine empathy and compassion. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the United States has returned to a unified government as Joe Biden became the 46th President of the United States and Democrats took control of the U.S. Senate. With the U.S. House continuing under Democratic leadership, Biden has an opportunity to enact big legislative changes. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports.
I, Joseph Robinette Biden Jr., do solemnly swear.
As he takes office, U.S. President Joe Biden faces considerable challenges. First among them, combating the coronavirus that has killed more than 400,000 Americans.
It requires Congress coming together to provide the necessary funding in the COVID relief package and the American Rescue Plan that I will soon be sending to the Congress.
Please raise your right hand.
But with Vice President Kamala Harris,
do you solemnly swear?
And three new senators, Democrats now have control of the U.S. Senate under now Majority Leader Chuck Schumer.
The Senate will tackle the perils of the moment, a once-in-a-generation health and economic crisis, and it will strive to make progress on generations-long struggle for racial justice, economic justice, equality of opportunity, and equality under the law.
An ambitious agenda for Democrats to pursue, but control of both the White House and both chambers of Congress helps clear the way.
Knowing that the president is of the same party, they know that anything that comes out of Congress is likely to get his signature on the bill instead of having a back and forth about a veto and trying to come up with a larger base of the Congress to vote on something to override any potential veto threat from the president. So it basically comes with unity and agenda control.
But Democrats have narrow margins in both chambers of Congress. And Republicans will still be able to block some bills that require 60 votes for passage in the Senate. In the House, Speaker Nancy Pelosi can only lose a few Democratic votes, and she has suggested there could be ways to work with Republican lawmakers.
We have a responsibility to find bipartisanship where we can, to find our common ground.
Quick passage of a new round of coronavirus relief for a struggling American economy comes first. But the new Democratic Senate will also move quickly to confirm the Biden cabinet nominees awaiting hearings.
The nomination is confirmed.
Unified control also gives the nation's legislative branch a greater ability to enforce government accountability. Despite their new majority, Democrats will still need to persuade 17 Republicans to convict former President Donald Trump if they hope to bar him from ever running again for federal office. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
During the pandemic, some schools are able to go to a so-called hybrid model where some students physically go to school while others remain at home and log in virtually. VOA's Elizabeth Lee tells us about a robot connecting students and teachers in a hybrid classroom.
2020 has been a weird year for high school student Sophia Jensen.
It's very strange, especially considering this is supposed to be like the last year of high school, like the fun time. And it's also like the most important semester is first semester. And now it's just like all upside down.
Jensen's school, like others during the pandemic, is offering hybrid classrooms where some students are physically in school while others log in from home. One thing helping students and teachers feel more connected is this robot called Swivel.
Imagine it almost if you had a student inside your classroom with a boom mic and a camcorder the whole time. And that's really what the Swivel does.
The Swivel includes a base that pairs with any mobile device. This base has a sensor and is able to track a marker with a built-in microphone worn by the teacher.
Swivel robot, which is in essence follows the teacher around the classroom and focuses the video camera on them.
It's given our teachers their legs back to be able to teach in a classroom, to be able to walk around.
The teacher can use common video conferencing apps with Swivel. It's better than just teaching with a computer, says science teacher Sarah McGuire.
The students can actually see the kids that were physically here in the classroom.
Jensen says tech-savvy teachers have no problem with Swivel, but for other teachers, there could be user error.
Swivel doesn't really follow them around the room. It'll sometimes just spin in like a random direction, and then they'll have to like chase after it. But when it does work, it's really nice because then it doesn't feel as much like I'm just staring at a screen. Feels a little bit more like I'm in a classroom.
Even when schools go back to normal, teachers say the Swivel can still help students who are out sick plug in to their classroom. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Thanks for joining us today on VOA Asia. Find us on all of our online platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We thank our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Hybels. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead. Be safe. Be well.